Support for this episode of A Year of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com, and the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetirregulars.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 153, The Rooms at 221B Baker Street.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, here comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street Irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, hello there. Welcome back, or welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Marty Allen. Oh, sorry. I'm Scott Monty.
I guess I'm Steve. Now, what was his partner? Marty Allen? It wasn't Steve Lawrence. Who was Marty Allen's partner?
No, that was Edie.
That was Edie Gourmet, but Marty Allen, he was part of a team of Allen and Rossi, Steve Rossi. That's right.
There you go. Well, hello there.
I'm Steve Rossi. Well, that's right. And you could also go back even farther to radio and, Baron Munchausen's tagline on the old 1930s radio programs was, Was you there, Charlie?
Wow. That is going back a ways. Well, we only go back to 1895 or so with this podcast. If you would like the show notes for this episode, they are available at ihose.co/ihose153, all lowercase, ihose.co/ihose153. You can find our website at ihearofsherlock.com. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as I Hear of Sherlock. We are always open to hearing from you. So whether you want to leave a comment on this particular episode on the show notes page, or if you want to email us, you can reach us at comment@ihearofsherlock.com. And of course, we always and still welcome your few and feeble phone calls. You can reach us at 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. Leave a comment there, and we'll probably play it on the show.
We'll definitely play it on the show.
Yes, we will.
And we love to hear people who speak who aren't us.
There are so many of them, aren't there?
Yeah, they're queuing up right now. Yeah. They say, be quiet.
Well, we hope you would also queue up to leave a rating or a review for the show on iTunes in particular. Just click on the link in the show notes. That'll take you right to iTunes, and you can tell people what you think of the show. Help other like-minded people discover what you already know. So, you probably already know about these folks, but we thought it's important for you to hear from them once again.
The ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex is looking forward to the fall harvest, when our peasants work in our fields, cut timber, haul water, spin and weave, and we collect their tithes. Every tenth egg, sheaf of wheat, lamb, chicken, and all the other animals. The peasant's lot is hard, but you can relax with your copy of a curious collection of dates through the year with Sherlock Holmes, highlighting every day with significant events from the Sherlockian universe. Available right now from our WessexPress.com. No faint and hesitating trill, such tribute as to winter chill the lonely redbreast pays, clear, loud, and lively is the din from social warblers gathering in. But you can tune it all out when you reach for the pleasure only a volume from the Wessex Press provides. Choose yours today. We can't hear too frequently from those bucolic, wonderful people in the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex. I mean, just think about what they're putting up with. All, you know, they started organizing those flea circuses, and then they found out about the plague. Oh, my goodness.
It happens. It happens to the best of us. Well, I am thrilled that we are actually going to be seeing the fine people at Wessex Press. And we don't even have to go far as the ancient and bucolic kingdom of Wessex this time around.
That's right. We will shortly be at Gillette to Bread 5. And I wonder if the people from the Wessex Press will be wearing, you know, their rough linen village costumes.
Well, if they are, you can guarantee that we will be there with photographic evidence. But if you are around, please stop by, say hello. We will have a table in the vendor's room. We'll also be out milling about as regular attendees of the conference as well. And we will actually be broadcasting live from the show floor. We're going to post that on our Facebook page. And we don't know exactly what the time is yet, but we will notify you within 24 hours of that happening. So please stay tuned for that to happen sometime this weekend, October 4th or 5th. I believe, is when it'll happen.
Yes. And the vendor's room is going to be special because we're going to have, as you just said, we're going to have a table there. We were working on our CD compilations that we were going to sell of the great moments of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. But there were actually so few of them that what we've come up with actually is little foot and foot and a half long strips of old cassette tapes that we're going to be selling. And you could stick these together with Scotch tape and play them in your antique Sony Walkmans.
Yeah. And each strip of cassette tape will only be $18.95. And it's first come, first served. So, it's a grab bag. See what you get. And look, if you're not able to be there in person and you can't take advantage of this wonderful offer, why don't you check out our 100th anniversary episode, ihose.co/ihose100. We actually had a number of flashbacks in that program as well. So it's probably the next best thing to participating in the in-person cassette raffle.
Yes, that's probably a good idea. You know, we were working on doing some MP3 collections, but we really can't. We don't have enough content. So what we're going to be doing instead of an MP3 collection is two MP one and a half collections.
Half off for your listening pleasure.
Yeah, you just have to group them together, that's all.
Well, it seems to be that travel is part of our genetic makeup recently here at I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. Bert, you were able to be on the road recently, and you had quite a special guest to visit and to interview. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I do. I was lucky enough to go to beautiful Exeter County, Pennsylvania, to the home of Denny Dobry. And Denny is a Sherlockian who first got connected to things Sherlockian sort of in the late 1980s. The big inciting event for Denny was, as you'll hear, the 100th anniversary of the publication of The Study in Scarlet. Denny grew up in Baltimore. He first became connected to Sherlock Holmes in high school and through the Rathbone pictures. He became a book collector, but things really clicked with him when he met a noted Sherlockian who we're about to talk about. In the mid-1960s, he became connected to science societies, and in 1998, he began building a recreation of the Baker Street sitting room. And after 20 years, it's really quite a remarkable construction. And we had our conversation in that very sitting room. And I began, as you'll hear, by welcoming Denny to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Oh, Bert, thank you, and welcome to 221B.
Yeah. I was just going to say, you know, we usually start by saying welcome to the show, but really, it's considering where we are, it's more like welcome to 1895.
That's where we are. It's always 1895 here.
So before we get into this amazing sitting room and its contents and what went into putting it together, let's start with the first question we always ask everybody we talk to, which is, when did you first meet Sherlock Holmes?
That would have been in junior high school. We read The Speckled Man, and something just clicked. I wasn't not much of a reader, even beyond that point, but something clicked. And over the years, I didn't really follow Sherlock Holmes that closely. I used to watch the Rathbone movies while I was in college. That kind of kept an interest, and I would read a story once in a while. But it wasn't until 1987 when the local newspaper published an article about the 100th anniversary of the publication of Study in Scarlet. And I realized, wow, there's a whole Sherlockian world out there. So that's when my interest really got piqued. And a number of years later, I went to my first Zion meeting at Watsonston Box in Baltimore. And from there on, it just grew.
Yeah. So you were born and you grew up in Baltimore.
That's correct.
Right?
Yep. East Baltimore. Yes.
And when did you find out that there were other – well, let's go back a bit. So when did you get – when did you read beyond that first story that you read in school?
Well, after 87 is really when I started to collect books and started to read more. So at that point, my interest is mostly very passive. I would follow Rathbone. You know, I had a busy life. I had a family. I had kids. I had work. So I didn't really get into it, and none of my friends were interested in it. And it wasn't until 87 that I realized there were a lot of people interested in Sherlock Holmes. So that's really when I started to read and start to collect books.
Interesting. And did you collect things other than Sherlock Holmes?
No. No, not really. I was a woodworker, so I collected tools. I still have lots of tools, and I still look at tools when I go to a hardware store. But no, my interests were basically Sherlock Holmes and scouting. I was into scouting. Yeah. I was a scoutmaster and a cubmaster. So that kind of filled up my time.
Yeah. Well, those are common. You know, those are – you'll find a lot of people with Sherlockian interests who share those pursuits. So when you were – at what point was it – was it early on? Because, you know, so many of – I think – I could be completely wrong. But I have the view that a lot of people who become Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts early on in that process are so captivated by the ambiance, by the settings of Victorian England, and particularly the sitting room, that they start to think to themselves, boy, you know, I wish I had – a sitting room. Was that an early idea, or did that come to you later?
It came to me much later. My environment was such that I didn't have a lot of outside people or anything influencing me to pursue the Sherlock Holmes idea. It wasn't until I met Paul Churchill in Baltimore in 95 or 96 that I really got things going. I was attending my first meeting in Baltimore, and I met Andy Solberg and Les Moskowitz at the meeting place for the Tin Box. And before the meeting, they said, while you're here in Baltimore, we're going to take you to Sherlock Holmes Museum. I said, okay. I didn't know there was one. He said, oh, yes, there is. It was Paul Churchill's house. They took me to Paul Churchill's house, and I was just blown away. Up to that point, I had collected books and the knick-knacky type things. But when I walked into Paul's and I saw artifacts from the stories, it just really blew me away. And that's really when my enthusiasm really got going.
Yeah. You know, it's a shame we never interviewed Paul on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. It would have been a good conversation. What did you make of Paul when you first – in fact, for those of our listeners who don't know who Paul Churchill, who's sadly passed on now, was, can you talk a little bit about Paul, about what made him special?
Paul was a Latin teacher who had lost his wife around, I think, 1989 or so. And he had been a Sherlockian up to that point, but after his wife passed on, he really started to concentrate. I think I'm sure it was a way to cope with his loss of his wife. And he was just, I never knew anyone who did not like Paul that met him. He was just one of the most gracious, witty, funniest guys you could ever want, and very, very generous. He always told me, he says, if I find two things, Sherlockian things, I will give one of them to another Sherlockian so that we have two happy Sherlockians. That was just the kind of guy he was.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about, you know, how his Sherlockian interests manifested themselves because as you just started to say, you know, he would go to great lengths to find or recreate items that had a particular reference to the cases of Sherlock Holmes or particular events, and would do an amazing job duplicating and creating some of these things.
Well, one of the first things he told me is that his initial goal was to find one artifact from every story. Well, he went way beyond that. And what he did, and he became famous for it, was to collect all the artifacts he found into what he called an evidence box. So each story, he had a physical box, whether it be cardboard, metal, or whatever, and he would take the artifacts that he found from that story, and he would keep them in an evidence box. Then he went to a meeting. If they were doing a particular story, he would take the evidence box from that story to the meeting to share it with the people at the meeting. And that's how he became known around the Sherlockian world and known for his evidence boxes.
Yeah. So can you remember one of the particular evidence boxes or some of the objects he had for a particular story?
Well, I remember the first item that really caught my attention was a Legion of Honor medal that he had that's mentioned in the Golden Pince-Nez. And, you know, I guess I didn't realize at this point that a lot of the items that are mentioned in the canon were real items, okay? Items that maybe we're not familiar with, but in Doyle's day, they were very commonly known, for instance, the gasogene, okay? I'm sure most people that read the Sherlock Holmes story for the first time and see the word gasogene say, what the heck was that? Well, there was a gasogene, all right, and that's what Paul did. He would bring a lot of these items that are not known generally to today's world, and he would make them real. He would put them in an evidence box for other people to enjoy.
Mm. And so so he was a real example for you.
Oh, absolutely. We became very close friends after that. In fact, I introduced Paul to Photoshop, and I think I created a monster there. He became known as the Master Forger. Any item that is mentioned in the canon that can be reproduced on paper, he did it. Again, he did it very well. He actually referred to Adobe Photoshop as Adobe Photoshop. Credit for me. But yeah, I taught him how to use that, and he just took off from there. He didn't need a whole lot of instruction after that. He went on his own. He's very creative. He's also an artist, a cartoonist. He had his drawings published in many, many publications over time. Yeah.
So what was your first step down the artifact path? I mean, you didn't start with the sitting room. You must have started small.
Oh, I did. I did. And a lot of things that I did accumulate were in conjunction with Paul. My situation at home at the time was really not inducive to have a sitting room. Okay. We had a house full. My daughter's family lived with us. And, it was always in the back of my mind after meeting Paul, gee, I'd like to do that, but it really wasn't in the cards until my daughter moved out. Now, once she moved out, I said to my wife, I would like to do what Paul did. I'd like to have a sitting room in the basement. And she looked at me and she said, you can do anything you want in the basement as long as you build me a screened-in porch. So that's what I did. I built the porch, and then I was free to do what I wanted in the basement. So that was in 1998 when I started to do the sitting room. And up to that point, I had collected a few artifacts here and there. But then after I started the sitting room, that's when it went into high gear.
Yeah. And you had a lot of talent and skill on your own, a lot of arrows in your own quiver to do this, because professionally you were, you had been an engineer, you retired relatively recently, and you're also a woodworker.
Right. So that was good. I mean, I didn't have to pay somebody to come in here and do the work. I did it all myself. My son helped me out with a couple of the heavier jobs, like doing the floor and the walls, the drywall. He helped me out with those. But all the woodwork I did myself. I built the fireplace myself and all the wainscoting in the room and the wallpaper and, you know, the painting of the buildings across the street. I did all that myself. I have some artistic talent, nothing compared to Paul, enough to get by.
So for, you know, those of our listeners who have not been here, and by the way, we should say something about the fact that you frequently, you know, make the sitting room open for visitors. So if folks are in the Exeter Township of Pennsylvania area or find that reachable, it's not impossible for them to contact you and come see the sitting room, and you have open houses from time to time.
Yes, I've said this many, many times. I really had a lot of fun building the room, but it's not any fun unless I can share it with somebody. So the room, and I also tell people I live here. So if you're in the area or can be in the area and you want to give me a call and come over, you're welcome, because I really enjoy showing it to people.
So for those who haven't been here yet, let's tell them a little bit about the experience. So from the first floor of the house, you go through a door. And do you come down 17 steps? I didn't count the steps. Are there 17 steps?
Now, that crossed my mind, but the hammering out the floor in the basement and taking out all the concrete kind of put that out of reach. It's a standard distance between
standard
floors, unfortunately.
Drop. So you come down the stairs, but the journey down the stairway is wonderful because you've decorated it with photographs of what appear to be all the actors from Maurice Costello and James Bravington on, who played Sherlock Holmes, and also many of the lobby cards and other things from the Rathbone pictures and others.
Right. What I did is, and I don't have all the actors. I don't think I have room for all the 3,200 that have portrayed Holmes. But what I did is I took the more known actors and I got photographs of them. I lined the one wall with all the photographs. They go from, what was the first one in 94, I believe, 1894. And the last one I have is Ian McKellen from Mr. Holmes. I think I'm going to pass on Sherlock Gnomes. I don't think he's going to make the wall. And I'm probably going to pass on Will Ferrell as well.
Well, I think that's probably a wise decision. So you come down that wonderful stairwell with all the photographs on one side and all the lobby cards on the other to a door with a very fierce-looking British lion, and the plaque 221B.
And then you come into the door, and you're in London. One of the greatest compliments that I received, I got from my sister-in-law when she first came in. She walked into the door, looked around, and turned around and left. She says, "I can't be in there. There's just something weird. I feel like I went back in time." And I just held up two thumbs and said, "Yeah, it works."
So you really have recreated. Now, the space is, as you said earlier, about 24 feet long and about 10 to 12 feet wide, depending on where you are. But it's uncanny. You have created a wainscoted, Victorian wallpapered, suitably tinned, ceilinged, sconce-lit, properly outfitted recreation of the sitting room, including two large windows. And when you come in with the sound going, the sound effects of hansom cabs in the street and a non-motorized London is really uncanny.
Oh, thank you. I mean, that was my goal. I think I've hit it pretty good. As I'm sure everyone knows, that there is no one set layout of 221B, okay? There's many different items that are mentioned in the stories. There are just more than can fit into the room, and that really goes back to the Victorian habit of changing furniture with the seasons. That's what the lumber room was for, because they would have summer furniture and they'd have winter furniture. In the summer, the summer or winter furniture went into the lumber room, and the winter furniture came out, or summer furniture came out. So he couldn't possibly fit everything into the room at one time that's mentioned in the canon.
So in your reading of the canon, have you uncovered, or looking at the illustrations, have you uncovered Holmes's summer furniture versus his winter furniture? Do you have any idea what his changes would have been?
I think just by chance that I have primarily summer furniture. But that really wasn't an idea that I shot for. I think it just kind of happened.
So tell us a little bit. So where did you start in as an engineer? Did you start with a floor plan, a design? Did you sketch things out ahead of time? How did you begin?
Well, first of all, I took the available space and made a sketch. I looked at the existing layouts, the one in the Sherlock Holmes Museum on Baker Street in London. That's pretty much the model that I used to do the layout. I put the windows and the chemical table and the fireplace in the same arrangements as they have at Baker Street. And the rest just kind of fell in place. Where things fit, that's where they went. Because, as I said, there really is no set layout in the canon of how the rooms were laid out. So that's pretty much it. This came together after laying out the fireplace and the windows.
And talk a little bit about the windows. How did you decide? Because that's, you know, what you've done here is you've built a little. Well, talk a little bit about what you've built with
all right,
the windows to give that illusion of being on the street.
Right. Well, as I said, I was relegated to the basement. So I was starting three floors too low to start with. Okay. Because the 221B flat was on the first floor English, which would be our second floor. And I was in the basement, so that's three floors difference. So somehow I had to create the illusion that we were on the second floor. So what I did is using Michael Harrison's London of Sherlock Holmes as a guide, I painted the facade of Baker Street across the street from the sitting room on the back wall. Then what I did is I built a fake wall in front of that, about a foot in front of that, to give you the illusion of depth. And with the curtains up and the lights on, when you sit back and look, it looks like you're looking across the street in Baker Street. So I think I've achieved that illusion of being on the second floor.
Yeah, particularly with the sound. You know, where did you get the soundtrack from?
Well, actually, this is my second reel of sound. The first sound track was given to me by Chuck Hrvacek, who is the founder of the Baker Street Builders, of which I am a member. He had a track done in a studio in California, and he sent me a copy. However, it was on a small cassette player. And I remember coming down here one morning and hearing this whining sound and realized I had forgot to turn the recorder off the night before and the tape had broken.
Oh.
So since then, my son found a soundtrack online of Victorian street sounds, and he put it on an MP3 player for me now. So now I can run 24/7 if I like and not have to worry about it breaking down.
Now, what's the Baker Street Builders? I haven't heard of that.
Chuck Hrvacek also has a sitting room, and was many, many years ago, before I met Paul, he started a Zionist society, the Baker Street Builders, and in order to become a member, you had to have a life-size reproduction of the sitting room. Chuck was number one. Paul was either two or three, and I became number four. Overall, there were some 20-some members. Not all are still active. Like in Paul's case, he passed away. And other people have moved and other things. But there were over 20 members total that were inducted into the builders.
And so you set out, you did a floor plan, worked out the position of these big anchor objects like the fireplace and the windows and so on. And then, because you're a woodworker, you did the wainscoting. You did the walls.
Right.
And the ceiling. And the doors are really quite remarkable. I mean, they're beautifully, fully hung wooden doors. And you must have plotted out the lighting, because you have a chandelier and 2, 4, 5 wall sconces going here that look very authentic.
Yeah, I mean, I did that. I mean, I had to do that. I just couldn't just start throwing things up without a game plan, and I did that. And I tried to be as period as possible. For instance, the hinges on the door are all period. The lock sets on the door are all period. The wallpaper is kind of an interesting story. I went to a wallpaper store. This is 20 years ago. They don't think they have wallpaper stores anymore. You have to go online to get your wallpaper anymore. But back then, there were wallpaper stores, and I went into a very large one, and they've had hundreds and hundreds of books of examples. And I picked up a book. I start looking, and I looked, and I looked, and I couldn't find what I want. Finally, a salesperson came over and said, "What are you, can I help you with anything?" And he said, "Well, I'm looking for something Victorian style." He walked away, came back, and opened up a book, and boop, there it was. I just wasted half an hour time when I could ask this guy, and he would have got it for me right away. So, and it fits perfect. It looks very good.
Yeah. Why don't you describe the wallpaper a little bit? How would you describe?
Well, it's a maroon, a very gaudy Victorian type wallpaper, and it fits very well into the room.
And you've got a border up at the top.
Well, that was the other problem. It relates back to not having 17 steps. The Victorian height of rooms were typically 9 to 10 feet, and I was pretty much stuck with 8. So what I tried to do is I put up a border along the top of the wall to hope to give a little bit of an impression of a little bit more depth than I actually had.
Mm. So when you set out to do this, I mean, you have the books, the descriptions in the canon, the other sitting rooms. What were some of the other decisions that you had to make about where things would go? Because while there is some specificity about the placement of objects in the sitting room, my memory is that occasionally things, let's put it this way, if we toted up all of the descriptions that Watson gives us about what's where in Baker Street, there would probably be 2 or 3 sitting rooms.
Correct. You can't, like I said before, you have to do with what you have. For instance, I had a sideboard that my wife's grandfather made.
Mm.
Okay. And it's an extremely nice piece of furniture. It looks Victorian. I did add a piece to the top of it to give it a second shelf. And it's rather large. It's 5 feet wide. Okay. So there wasn't a lot of places that I had a choice to put that. It fit in one particular area. The fireplace setting, we had to have the 2 chairs in front of the fireplace and the octagonal table between them, which is typical for a Sherlock Holmes sitting room layout. So that was kind of fixed that as well. So with the fireplace, the chairs, and the sideboard, that kind of narrowed down where I could put other things. Watson's desk got set in a corner. Holmes' desk got between the 2 windows in the front. And everything else just kind of fell into place.
Mm. Now, where did you get the octagonal table? Because we've talked about that on our programs before. It's not, you don't just go to IKEA and say, "I think I need an octagonal table."
Well, like a lot of sources that I use, I probably bought that one on eBay. Probably got on eBay. I don't remember anymore. Yeah. A lot of the things I get at antique stores, most of the furniture, obviously, I got at antique stores. And if I didn't find what I liked or I couldn't afford what I liked, I would make it. In fact, the table we're sitting at right now, I made in my shop. The chemical table, which was a deal top table, I made that myself. So, again, what I couldn't find, I could make, I made.
Hmm. Well, so once you have – and by the way, it's just beautiful, including the fireplace with the trompe d'oeil marble I'm presuming it is trompe d'oeil marble.
Yes.
It's not real. It's beautifully done. Did you paint that yourself?
Yes.
Ah, that's just beautiful. And, of course, the mantle with the jackknife and the letters, all very authentic. So you make some decisions. You lay out the basic arrangement of the sitting room. You go to work and put in the walls and the doors and the wainscoting and the wallpaper and some of the major pieces of furniture. But now you have to deal with the fact that Holmes was in active practice for many years, that we have 60 cases, and that likely there are items, particularly as we discussed earlier with Paul Churchill, there are items from all of those cases somewhere in the sitting room. So where did you start? What did was your goal to have an item from every case somewhere in the sitting room, and what did you begin with?
Yeah, I mean, that was my goal. It's same as Paul, his initial intent was to have at least one artifact from every story. And what I did is I sat down with the canon, and I took notes. I read every story again, took notes of every physical item that was in the canon. And about 2 months later, Steve Clarkson published his compendium, which did exactly what I had done meticulously. A couple months too early for that. Steve could have saved me a lot of work, but I do use his compendium now. If I want to add something else to the room, I often go to his book. And by the way, he had been here before he passed away. He used to visit with Paul Churchill. So that's what I did. I went and I made an inventory of all the items, and then I went searching.
What was one of the first things you acquired?
Actually, one of the first items that I found were calling cards. Okay, there are a number of calling cards mentioned in the story. Mary Morstan, for instance, Mrs. Hudson serves up one of her calling cards on a brass salver to Holmes and Watson. Of course, I did that on Photoshop, and Paul was amazed. That's when I introduced him to Photoshop. So that was really one of the first artifacts that I created. As far as items that I found, probably some chemistry equipment. I have quite a bit of chemistry equipment on the chemistry table. I think I probably found that early on. I didn't find a gasogene for a long time. It took a while before I found one, and I have both a gasogene and a celsogene in the sitting room along with the tantalus.
The confines of 221B Baker Street have always been filled with objects that to the typical Sherlockian are something of holy relics. The Stradivarius, the Persian slipper, the tantalus and gasogene, the basket chair, and on and on. These things are parts of a whole that are now so widely known and recognized that, examined separately, any single one of these could instantly give away the address of that fabled sitting room. Throughout the pages of the Baker Street Journal, beginning in 1946 and continuing nearly uninterrupted until today, Sherlockians have poured forth on so many of these literary artifacts. The result is a well-informed reader who knows not only how these items fit into the stories with Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, but who also appreciates their origins and historical significance. If you'd like to learn more about the interior of 221B Baker Street, order a copy of the EBSJ. There, you'll find a digital archive of all the Baker Street journals from 1946 to 2011 in an easily searchable PDF format. The EBSJ is your key to opening the door to 221B and beyond. Visit BakerStreetIrregulars.com and get your EBSJ today.
Now let's stop there and talk a little bit about that, because we have on our programs, I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere and also Trifles, we've talked, and on Trifles once a month we try to talk about items that can be found in the sitting room, and we did talk about a gasogene, but you say we got it wrong in that, well, talk a little bit about that. So what's the true nature of the gasogene?
Okay, a gasogene is used to make seltzer water back in Victorian times. It was not pre-bottled back then. They actually produced it by putting a bicarbonate of soda into one of the two vessels and water in the other, flipping the item upside down, and creating pressure and seltzer water. A company in France actually produced two models. One was a gasogene and one is called a celsogene. They do exactly the same thing. They're just different designs. The celsogene, which most Sherlockians will refer to as a gasogene, has round globes on top and bottom, whereas a gasogene itself is they're more oval type egg shaped globes on the top and bottom. The gasogene is coated with cane to in the event that the pressure would build up and it would explode, the people in the room wouldn't be shattered with glass. And I've never seen, and you mentioned it on your show, that they were covered with wire, but I've never seen a gasogene covered with wire. They're always covered in cane. A celsogene, however, is typically covered with wire.
And what's the difference? Do they both operate in the same way, or are they just manufactured by different companies? Or?
They're actually manufactured by the same company. I think the patent goes back to around 1870. They are both do exactly the same thing, but they work upside down. In the gasogene, the water goes in the top, and in the seltzogene, the water goes in the bottom to start, and the powder in the opposite. I'm not sure why, but I'm sure the engineers that did that had a reason for designing two different types.
Hmm. And I wonder why one would be wrapped in wire and one in cane, because you'd think that, you know, if it's going to explode, the pressure that would cause it to explode would be identical in both.
I don't know. I mean, it may have been an aesthetic thing. The cane looks very nice. It's a nice instrument to have in your sitting room.
Yeah.
So it may have been an aesthetic thing.
So what were some among the hardest things to find? I mean, it's not every day you're going to wander around and find a gasogene or a seltzogene, but what else?
Well, for many years, people would ask, what is left? What do you not have in your room that you're really looking for? And my answer was always Watson's service revolver. And I did a lot of research, and I actually made an error in the selecting what pistol I should be looking for. My initial research came up with a Enfield Mark II, I believe, and I found one. And I purchased it, and I was very happy. Then I realized I messed up. The Enfield was not issued to the British Army until August of 1880, which would have been after Maiwand and after Watson would have gotten his pistol.
Huh.
So I looked around and did some more research and realized I had made an error and determined that the Adams Mark III was the official British issue from 1872 to August of 1880. So that would have been a pistol that would have been available to Watson to use as his service revolver. British officers were required to purchase their own revolver, and the only restriction was it had to be a .45 caliber so that they were using the same ammunition as everybody else. But Watson, in my opinion, wouldn't have gone out and searched out any special weapon. I think he probably would have been satisfied with just using the same weapon that the enlisted soldiers were using. So I found one, and I bought it, and I have it.
Did you have to go to gun shows and things like that?
I have gone to a couple of gun shows, but mostly online auctions. I bought this on an online auction.
Huh, amazing. And you've got a number of revolvers here because we were looking earlier at the big service revolver as well. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
All right. In the speckled band, Holmes says to Watson, an Eli number 2 would do great service to a man who can bend a poker in half. Eli didn't make weapons. They made ammunition. But there was a Webley number 2 that used Eli ammunition. So I'm sure Holmes was referring to a Webley number 2 pistol when he referred to that gun in the speckled band. So I have one of those as well. It's a smaller weapon than the service revolver, much handier to carry around in your pocket as opposed to the Adams 3.
Mm.
And the other weapon, I have a couple more weapons. I have the pin-fired pistol from Wisteria Lodge. When they go into the lodge after the crime has been discovered, they find an old pin-fire pistol laying on a desk. I have one of those. And I guess one of the prizes that I have is I have Moran's air rifle. It's a beaut. It is really, really nice. I was very lucky to find it. I found it on an inline auction. Watson describes it as having a curiously misshapen butt, and this one certainly it has a misshapen butt. And he also describes a grinding sound. Well, this rifle has a handle on it for to be pumped up to build up the pressure in the rifle, and I think it's the very one. I really do.
It's amazing, absolutely amazing. Yeah. Now, for those of our listeners for whom the phrase air rifle conjures up a Red Ryder BB gun and you'll shoot your eye out, kid. This is not that kind of a thing at all. This is a really substantial, looks like oak, and it must weigh 20 pounds.
It weighs, 16 actually, 16 yeah. pounds. Yeah, I watch people's reaction when I hand it to them because they're always surprised at how heavy it looks, how heavy it is.
And you would crank the butt of this thing, turn this huge crank on the side, and thereby build up pressure.
Right.
And then pull the trigger and theoretically a cartridge would whoosh out of the air rifle.
Yep.
Well, you also have the destination of the bullet. You have the bust by Monsieur Meunier of Grenoble. Talk a little bit about that. And how did the bullet hole get in there? Did you shoot shoot the bust yourself?
No, that's a electric drill that did the work there.
Wow. Your secret is safe.
And actually, the mannequin itself is – I made that from a store, department store mannequin, without a face. What I did is I purchased a life mask of Basil Rathbone, which are readily available. You can find those. What they did is the studios created those masks to practice makeup on the act for the actors. So I found that, and I pasted it on top of the store mannequin, did a little paint, added a little hair, and drilled a hole in it. And
there you are.
Yeah.
And you've got the appropriate VR bullet marks in the wall. Now, I'd be disappointed to find out you didn't shoot those yourself.
If that's what you want to believe. Actually, I didn't have the heart to punch holes in my wall after all the work I did to put the walls up. They are actually drawn on.
Oh.
But it must have been done well. You seem surprised.
Yes. Yes. No, it works well. Well, that makes a lot of sense. You don't want to punch holes in your own wall.
And in reality, if he had really put that many bullet holes into the wall probably would have collapsed. So.
Well, so what are some of the other objects? I mean, we're sitting here at the dining table at 221B, and on the table is the very lamp that was the last thing that poor Brenda Tregenna saw with the talc
shield
up at the top. Talk a little bit about some of the – now, for example, where if I get up one morning and I want a basket chair, do I go to basketchair.com and see what's in stock?
Actually, I found the basket chair at a antique mall a number of years ago. And actually, I conversed with Chuck Hrvacek to see what a basket chair was. And his idea, his description was that a chair that was made out of cane or wicker that extended to the floor. So that's what I was looking for. I was looking for a wicker chair that extended to the floor, and that's what I found.
Oh, I see. So as opposed to being on legs.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. Interesting. I remember Morley referred to this as Minty's varsity chair in one of his essays, because that's when he was a student at Oxford as his Rhodes Scholarship. That's what he was familiar with in the dormitories. And you've got a magnificent fainting couch. Are any visitors so moved that they frequently faint and recline on the fainting couch?
Not yet, but there's still hope. You know, what's interesting about the Victorian fainting couch is it was just for that. They were actually on wheels, because if a woman back then, of course, they were tied up in all these corsets, and it wasn't unusual for them to feel faint. And the fainting couch was built or had wheels on it so that the gentleman in a room could easily wheel the fainting couch over to the damsel in distress, and so she would fall on the fainting couch.
Wonderful. So what else? Here's one thing I wanted to sort of discuss with you. You know, you made the observation early on when I visited earlier today that, you know, one of the issues about living in Baker Street is that Holmes accumulated a lot of paper. He was forever getting telegrams. He was forever opening up dispatch boxes. There would be letters inside. What was your inspiration for how to handle all of that volume in Baker Street?
Well, I have to go back to Paul's sitting room. Okay, Paul accumulated many, 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 many items, and a lot of it was paperwork, newspapers, and his answer was either to put them in his evidence box or just leave them scattered around the room. Well, I didn't want to do the evidence box idea. And I didn't really want to have just papers laying all over. So I got my inspiration from A Study in Scarlet. Towards the end of the story, Watson says, I'm going to save all the newspaper clippings from this case and put them in my scrapbook. Okay, that gave me the idea to create Watson's scrapbook. So that's what I've done. I have all 60 stories with the newspapers, photographs, all the paper inside scrapbook, and you can sit down and you can read the canon in pictures.
Well, and it's amazing because you've got all the bits, you know, the telegrams that would have arrived, the notes, the scrawled notes, everything arranged in the chronological order that Watson would have received it.
Right, exactly.
Now, one thing we didn't look at is Holmes' good old index, which I see on the wall here. If I were to take, what would I find if I took down one of those volumes?
That's against the rules.
That's very wise.
Yeah, I have not. Those are there because they need to be there. However, I haven't gotten around to actually making those authentic.
So your collection of M's is not yet a fine one.
That's correct. Yeah.
So what else? What are some of the things you're most proud of in terms of the story-related memorabilia that you have here? Because you've got everything. You've got Watson's tin dispatch box. You've got the box Holmes dragged out, in which when you open it, you find you've got the records of his early cases neatly done up in red tape. So you've got so much here. But what are you most proud of in connection with all the cases, the various bits of memorabilia?
Well, you had asked earlier what was one of the first things I found, and I just realized looking around, the Penang walking stick, Penang Warrior walking stick from Dr. Mortimer's and the Hound. Okay, that was one of the first things I found, that now that I recall. And I found that also at a antique mall, an outdoor antique mall. I almost passed up on it. That's one lesson I've learned, is if you see something you want and need, get it. Don't pass it up, because it may not be there next time you go back. And I almost passed up on this, but I decided, nope, I'm going to get it.
Now, how did you know it was a Penang lawyer?
Oh, I had did some research as to what it looks like, I found it. It had a silver band on it. It also has the engraving on it that belongs there. It wasn't there when I found it, by the way, but it does now. And the Penang Lawyer is actually the natural Penang Lawyer is made from a palm tree. And the one that Dr. Mortimer had would have been one that was produced by a craftsman. It was in the same shape as the natural palm tree, but, nicely finished.
Yes, and I've just picked that up, and you even have the tooth marks of Dr.
Yes.
Mortimer's dog.
Yep.
Well, that's brilliant.
Yeah, the other thing that I'm kind of proud of, and Bert, you were looking at it earlier, is Trelawney's Hope's dispatch box. Okay, there were seven letters besides the one in the blue envelope that are mentioned in the canon, and I miraculously have found all those, and they're now in the dispatch box, which we have.
So what does your family make of all this? I mean, we haven't spoken to your wife, but if she were here, what would she say? How does it feel to have Baker Street in the basement?
Well, she's sitting in her screen room in porch right now, and she could care less that we're down here at this point. No, she's happy with her screen room. She is not a Sherlockian, although she is an avid reader. She probably reads three or four books a week. Mm. But she's read one or two Sherlock Holmes stories, and she just is not moved by them. So she reads other mysteries and crime stories, and she's satisfied with that. She will go to a meeting with me occasionally. She goes mostly for the meal and for friendship. We have most of her friends are Sherlockians. So, she enjoys that. But as far as the actual stories in the Sherlock Holmes world, she's not really interested.
Yeah. Well, we're sitting here in a perfect recreation of 221B Baker Street with the sound turned off. If we had the sound turned on, you could hear the clip clop of the cabs in the street. The table is set as if Holmes and Watson are going to be here any moment for tea. There's an Inverness on the coat rack, a deerstalker on the wall, Chinese Gordon on the wall. We're also quite near something else. You know, we should talk a little bit about your other initiatives on behalf of the Baker Street Irregulars. You've become the one of the primary book dealers for the Baker Street Irregulars Trust. Can you talk a little bit about, and you have a what's virtually a store full of books down here in the other part of your house. Can you talk a little bit about that, about the books and the trust and so on?
Yeah, I'm good friends with Andy Solberg, who is the chairman of the BSI Trust. And 3 years ago, Andy received a number of boxes of books and other Sherlockian paraphernalia from the Jerry Wachs estate. When Jerry passed away, they donated the things to the BSI Trust. Well, most of the items really are not archival-type items, but they were of value, and Andy intended to sell them to raise money for the trust. Well, Andy's busy with his own things and everything, and he didn't really have time to initiate that, so I volunteered to take that on. I've been doing it for 3 years, and Sherlockians are very generous. I have received many, many, many books and other things that have been donated to trust, and I'm pushing around $18,000 in funds that I've raised so far for the BSI Trust. And it continues. It seems like it, you know, once you get the ball rolling, everybody wants to clear their shelves off for more stuff, I guess, and I get the rest of it that they're casting off. So, and it's been fun. It's been a lot of fun. Mike Whalen refers to me as the Fuller Brush Man of the BSI. So.
Well, it's fabulous what you're doing, you know, and, you know, it's a not inconsiderable amount of effort to package, sell, book, you know, cash checks, provide all these things. You're a book dealer.
Yeah, I see it as a challenge, you know, and it's fun. I look forward to when I know I'm going to get a shipment of things from people just to see what's there. You know, and there's a lot of stuff that I get that probably I'll never be able to sell. There's just too much of it. But probably what I'll do with some of that, I'll probably donate them to libraries and things like that to reduce my inventory, because I probably have on site now probably around 1,500 items. And later next October, the family of Philip K. Jones has decided to donate Philip's collection to the BSI Trust. He lives in Detroit. I'll be traveling out to Detroit at the end of next month to pick up his collection. And I've been there before, and they say so far they've packed up 25 boxes, and they just got started. So that should be quite a haul to bring back. So we're planning to have actually two book fairs in the spring. One in New Jersey, New York area, and one in the Baltimore, Washington area. There'll be more on that as time comes about. So hopefully that we'll get a bunch of Sherlockian collectors there to buy some books.
Yeah. Well, sounds good. I'll be there.
Good.
So when you began the sitting room here, how long did all this take you? It's a question I wanted to ask you earlier. When did you start?
All right.
And do you think you've finished?
I'll never be finished. Okay. There will always be something that I find in one of the stories and I said, oh, I don't have that. I'll proceed to find it or make it or get a hold of it. I started in 1998 when my daughter moved out, and I cut the deal with my wife. Okay. And I started to do research, the layout, as we talked about, the design, how things were going to be. And I started to build it. I was still working at the time, so it took me a year to do the infrastructure, to get the walls up and before I moved any furniture in. So it would have been at the end of 1999 when I actually finished the room.
And
well, I say finished. I finished the infrastructure. Yeah.
Yep, and then began populating it, and here we are 20 years since you began.
Yep. And it's been a work of love. I mean, it's been a lot of fun. I mean, and also educational. I mean, I read the canon completely different than most people read. Okay, I look for detail in items and physical items, reference to books. I mean, I've got a lot of the books that were mentioned in the canon on home shelf or Watson shelves. It's just fun. It's interesting.
And you mentioned earlier that you occasionally bring in high school classes visit, and when they do, you give them a quiz.
Yeah, there is one teacher that teaches in one of the local high schools who for 3 years now, well, this will be the fourth, has brought his class, his English class here to the sitting room. Prior to coming to the sitting room, he has them read a number of stories from the canon. He tells me ahead of time which ones they've read. And when they get here, I give them a quiz based on the stories that I know that they've read. And, of course, most of them have to do with artifacts. For instance, one of the quizzes was find how many items can you find from the Study in Scarlet. And the winning team, there's usually they break them up into teams. The winning team receives copies of the annotated Sherlock Holmes, the Baring Gould edition. And, again, when I'm looking at places for things for the sitting room, I also keep a keen eye out for copies of the annotated, so I have them for prizes.
And when the kids come in, what's their reaction? I mean, what do they think?
It's a whole range. You got some kids who are just glad to get out of the classroom, could care less about Sherlock Holmes, and then you have other ones that are extremely, enthusiastic about it. This past year, the one boy, he knew a lot. I was really surprised. He's already a first class Sherlockian.
Well, you're helping continue in a way the next generation of Sherlockians by coming here and seeing things and getting excited.
Well, you know, now that you bring that up, you'll bring up Beacon Society. Okay, I am also the headlight of the Beacon Society, and for those of you who don't know about the Beacon Society, our goal is to introduce Sherlock Holmes to our youth. Each year we give grants to teachers in high schools and librarians to promote Sherlock Holmes to the youth that they deal with. We are in the middle of a fundraising effort right now. In fact, if you go to our website, beaconsociety.com, you can get the information on there and how you can help us out, how you can join up and become a member of the society. So I urge you all to do that because, most Sherlockians, if you ask them what's important to you, and they'll say keeping green the memory of the master. Well, that's what the Beacon Society does by getting our youth involved with Sherlock Holmes.
Well, thank you for everything you're doing for this generation of Sherlockians and the next. And thanks for opening up the sitting room, and thanks for joining us on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Well, thank you, Bert. And again, I like visitors, so if you're – and make your way to Reading, Pennsylvania, look me up.
Well, what a delightful and wide-ranging conversation that was.
It's really amazing. This is a great stream. I was very surprised in the conversation, although I suppose I shouldn't have been, with Denny to find out that there was this science society called the Baker Street Builders of people who have actually recreated the sitting room. And, of course, I knew and liked Paul Churchill very much and knew of his evidence boxes and have seen many of them. But it didn't occur to me until this particular conversation that this is a great stream or a theme of Sherlockian interest. I mean, there are folks who, when they look at these stories, these 60 cases, and they look at the interesting artifacts that come up in each case, the great box of jewels, the great Agra treasure, the lost crown of the Stuarts, the snuff boxes, the letters, the dispatch boxes, all of these things, say to themselves, I wonder if I could find something like that. And it's just amazing when you're actually in the presence of all those things in one place.
Yeah, it's impressive. I have not yet had the chance to get there. Denny lives a little farther away from me than he does from you. But from what I have seen of pictures that he has shared, it is quite impressive. And, I think we discussed this in an earlier episode, some of the museum recreations of the sitting room, in Switzerland at the Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle Museum there. In certainly in London, a couple of different places, you've got the sitting room in the Sherlock Holmes pub, and you've got the actual recreation in Baker Street at the Sherlock Holmes Museum proper. Everyone has a slightly different take on it, but it is instantly recognizable, no matter where you enter these recreations, where you're supposed to be.
Yeah, and you think about the effort, as as Denny and I talked, you know, if you are in the market for a Persian slipper, it's not, you know, you just can't go to PersianSlipper.com or Amazon.com and put in Persian slipper and click and get one.
Well, maybe that's a new business idea then.
Yes, for Sherlock Holmes brand products.
Sure.
I guess so. Well, I think we did. I think there was a Sherlock Holmes brand product about sitting room recreations, but I think it was more IKEA-like than authentic.
quite. Well, we are almost toward the end of the show here. We do have the Canonical Couplets quiz coming up in just a moment. Before we do that, just want to remind you that we will be in Bloomington, Indiana, at the end of the week here. We're releasing this episode at the top of the week, so we'll be at the Gillette to Brett conference. It's going on, I think, officially from October 3rd through the 5th. Most of the activity takes place on the 4th. And as we lock down our live streaming time, we are going to have a video version of our program. So you will see and hear us as we come to you from Bloomington, Indiana at the Gillette to Brett 5 conference. So stay tuned for that. Get updates on our Facebook page. If you are not yet a member, just go to facebook.com/IHearOfSherlock.
Looking forward to that. And we'll do some audio recording too. I'm going to bring my my portable set up, and we'll see if we can talk to some speakers and things as we did at the Chautauqua conference.
Yes. So
there'll be lots of ways to participate.
Stay tuned. Well, that music means that it is time for us to toddle on over into the game show theater for another episode of Canonical Couplets. Now, if you remember the last time around, we offered you another two-line stanza where you had to identify a tale from the original Sherlock Holmes stories based on what we said. And this one was fairly easy. We had a lot of entries this time around. The entry was, "The fundamental tale wins hearty praise from all who overlook its Mormon phase." You know the adventure alluded to in that, Bert?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That was a study in Baskerville.
No, it was the Hound of the Valley. Come on.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I forgot about Porlock. No, wait a minute. It wasn't Porlock. It was Pycroft. No, wait a minute. I can't have a Pycroft. There's too much lard in the crust.
Well, that was, in fact, as you all have probably surmised by now, A Study in Scarlet. Of course, the Mormon half of that book. Some people love it. Other people do not. It's an acquired taste, just like Pycroft. Well, who won this time around? We have to spin the big prize wheel once again. Wait for that revolving drum to slow down. We get to number five. And let's see, who does that correspond to this time around? Looks like it is Eric Deckers. Eric, congratulations. We'll be sending you a little something from right here in the IHO's vaults. So now we need to recast our spinning poetry wheel, and this time come up with the latest canonical couplet. And here it is. "The secret rigmarole directly beckoned to legal assets of Charles II. If you think you know which story that alludes to, please send us an email. The subject line should be Canonical Couplet, and it should be addressed to comment@IHearOfSherlock.com. Good luck.
Oh, I like that one. That's a very good one. All of these, you know, are really nice. I really admire them.
We're trying, you know, and we've only got about a year's worth of these left. Maybe a year and a half worth left. because there are only 60 canonical couplets that we've got here. And then we'll have to try something else.
You know, people love raffles and things. Maybe for the our table in at the Gillette Brett conference. By the way, Denny will be there.
Hmm.
He's driving in from Pennsylvania. You know, maybe we could do a raffle or a prize or a drawing or some canonical couplets on site and see what happens.
Sure. Maybe a 50-50 raffle.
Oh, I like that. If I can get a quarter of the take, that would be fine.
Oh, well, good luck on that one, too.
Yeah.
Well, gird yourself for the journey west, or at least Midwest, Bert, and I will be in Indiana to welcome you with open arms. Until then, I will remain Scott Monty.
And I am stuck, but happily stuck, in being Bert Walder.
The game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.